it's incumbent upon the press to explain, no, this really is the politics of suicide, and it's insane for anyone to vote for it.
Do the media really explain consistently and clearly why the government shut down to begin with? From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Healthcare.gov launched at the beginning of this month, and the results were unpalatable.
The kitchen caught fire. The waiters had no idea what was going on. Everybody was running around screaming, and the people were out there in the dining room waiting for their healthcare to show up, and nothing happened.
Also, getting your DNA tested is as easy as spitting into a vial, but be warned, the results may be hard to swallow.
I think maybe young people have a tendency to imagine dying very dramatically. I didn't think it was going to say, you need to take care of yourself, otherwise, as you get older.
All that and more coming up.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
To borrow a phrase from a past crisis, the long national nightmare is over.
That was CNN's Kate Baldwin Thursday with a powerful description of what happened this week. That's how many media voices portrayed the end of the shutdown. In spite of that portrayal being utterly untrue. As long as congressional Republicans can use routine debt limit approval to sue for Democratic concessions, there's every possibility we will be back in the nightmare in 4 months as the next deadline approaches. As for the media's characterization of the economic fallout, that went mostly like this.
And congratulations, America. We have not defaulted on our national debt by the skin of our teeth.
Reuters financial blogger Felix Salmon says that the close call narrative that played out Thursday is an altogether misleading, if comforting, depiction of what really happened.
In a very real sense, the government is in default on its obligations. If we were to default on our treasury bonds, it's not like we're not going to pay you and you're just going to have to take losses on your bonds. But what it means is we are not going to pay our obligations as they come due. And that's exactly what we've already started doing with the government salaries. What people can't do anymore is just implicitly trust that the obligations of the U.S. government are what's known as risk-free assets. This is this absolutely key concept in the financial markets. And it's just impossible anymore, after what we've just seen, to believe that there is zero risk.
Now that once again the final negotiations have been postponed on the debt ceiling, the operating cliche is we have kicked the can down the road.
We are kicking the can, but better to kick the can than to stomp on the can.
At the same time, we can't keep kicking the can down the road.
Instead of kicking the can down the road.
Kick the can down the road.
And kick the can down the
road. The can kicking metaphor is one which we're very used to in the financial press. It invariably refers to countries which have very gnarly problems which can't be easily solved. And so what they do is implement legislation which causes those problems to just rise up again down the road. That is not the situation that we're facing right now. The entire problem could go away as a stroke if we just abolish the debt ceiling. That is not an insurmountable problem. There's a piece of legislation, the McConnell Amendment, which would surmount it. And so we're taking a tractable problem and forcing it to come back time and again for no reason.
As these things come up, how should the press be focusing its coverage? And how should we be doing it in particular this week?
Some of the better coverage that I saw was coming from abroad. You would get people going to Mexico, Brazil, India, China, South Africa, and looking at the U.S. through the eyes of foreigners who are just absolutely shocked and appalled and can't believe what they're seeing. And to just pull back a bit, get that kind of perspective, and to try and explain that this is not some kind of a game where so long as we manage to come up with a solution before some artificial deadline, that everything's going to be okay.
Well, I know somebody who agrees with you there.
And then this morning, I get the Wall Street Journal out, and it says, well, we don't care how long this lasts because we're winning. This isn't some damn game.
That was Speaker of the House John Boehner about 10 days into the crisis. One of the ironies of this whole episode, it seems to me, is that the global financial stability that hangs in the balance and the devastation to the U.S. economy was triggered by the Tea Party minority in the House of Representatives and one loud U.S. senator, all based on Obamacare, which they claim is a dangerous, dangerous law because it's going to wreak havoc on our economy, and they say is wreaking havoc on us now, that it's going to increase deficits, that's going to increase the national debt. Just on the face of it, are those conditions even present or expected over the next, let's say, 10 years, according to neutral economists?
Well, there's a whole arm of the government called the Congressional Budget Office, which is tasked with exactly this question. And if you ask the CBO about Obamacare, they'll say, no, it really doesn't do what the Tea Party says it's going to do. I'm going to go with the CBO on this one.
So I guess my ultimate question is, should it not be a staple of coverage to remind readers and listeners and viewers, more or less every step along the way, that this whole ongoing catastrophe is premised on political rhetoric that is fundamentally untrue?
Yeah, I wish. I would love that. It wouldn't change much, to be honest, because it's very difficult to argue someone out of an ideology using Congressional Budget Office speculation about what may or may not happen to debt-to-GDP ratios in the future.
If the press understands institutionally that reporting the context properly and regularly is not going to have an effect on a major player in the debate, namely the Tea Party Republicans, does that absolve us of the responsibility to do our job?
Absolutely not. No, we should be out there explaining the facts as clearly as possible, as regularly as possible, and not just in the last crazy few days before the debt ceiling is reached. It's incumbent upon the press to explain, no, this really is the politics of suicide, and it's insane for anyone to vote for it.
Felix, as always, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Felix Salmon covers international finance for Reuters. Andrew Tyndall runs the Tyndall Report. He's been monitoring the nightly network news for some 20 years. We called him to follow up on the conversation we had 2 weeks ago with The Atlantic's James Fallows, who'd detected in newspaper editorial pages a tendency toward false equivalency, in this case assigning culpability for the crisis to Washington dysfunction as opposed to a renegade Tea Party minority. Tyndall says network TV, by its nature, fell into the same pattern.
Television news is very interested in anecdotalizing and personalizing any abstract story. One of my favorites was NBC's Harry Smith giving us the mating sound of the elks in Yellowstone National Parks and the tourists who would not be around to listen to this annual ritual of the fall.
A visit to Yellowstone affirms our belief in America as a special place. But if the government shuts down, so will the park. And that's a shame.
The implicit message of all of these anecdotes is dysfunctional Washington has harmed real people. Not the true story, which is this is a crisis that's going on inside the Republican caucus of the House of Representatives.
Andrew, you suggest that this leaves the blame at the feet of institutional Washington as opposed to the feet of the Tea Party caucus. I see it more of a Rorschach test. I believe it's the fault of the Tea Party, and perhaps others interpret it based on their political worldview that says, oh, no, it's the Democrats who obsessively cling to the flawed policy of Obamacare. Is this false equivalency or is it just a Rorschach test?
It's a problem of lack of specificity. Yes, generally speaking, it is a problem of dysfunctional Washington. The more specific we get in describing who are the people who are failing to come to a compromise, as revealed over the last 2 weeks, the actual conflict was going on inside Speaker Boehner's caucus. That's not a question of a Rorschach test. That's a question of being precise.
The story, Harry Smith's assignment, was to put some flesh and blood on what seems like the usual intractable inside the Beltway conflict. And he does that. Is every reporter responsible in every story for the political context for what triggered the story to begin with?
No. The responsibility of the editors and the producers to put together a series of packages which look at the problem from all sides, give vivid real-world examples, including cute nature scenes, but also give precise sound bites from actual politicians actually involved in the activity. However, the other side of the coin on television news, when it is covering actual inside the Beltway politics, is also to personalize this story, to cover the White House rather than to cover Congress, a single recognizable person rather than a gaggle of people, most of whom are nameless and faceless as far as the viewer is concerned.
Do you think TV viewers in general, had they depended only on cable news channels and the networks, would have come away inevitably with the notion that parties are equally responsible?
Careful TV viewers would have found enough coverage which offered the specificity that I'm talking about. However, the default position as network television news, not the more ideological cable channels, is to try and find the center ground if at all possible, and also to try and get out of the political weeds and into the lives of real people, if at all possible. Both of these tendencies fought against the specific sort of coverage which would have given an accurate picture.
Andrew, thanks so much.
No problem.
Andrew Tyndall runs the website The Tyndall Report.
Coming up, why did the new Affordable Care website stumble so badly right out of the gate?
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. On the Media is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform designed to provide a simple way to create a website, portfolio, or online store for business or personal use. Squarespace provides templates and drag-and-drop tools to create professional websites. Users create sites that are mobile-ready with 24/7 support, domain names, and e-commerce all included on the same platform. For a free trial, visit squarespace.com/media. Support for On the Media also comes from The New School, offering graduate programs in media studies and media management. These flexible cross-disciplinary programs are designed to carefully balance theory and practice so students are fully engaged with current media scholarship, as well as the latest tools of media production and management. The programs can be completed on campus in New York City, online, or in a combination of on-campus and online study. More information about the New School's graduate programs in media studies and media management is available at newschool.edu/media NYC.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. There was at least one juicy irony in the debt ceiling standoff that the fuss made over manufactured problems with the Affordable Care Act distracted press and the public from the real and documented cluster fail in the rollout of the program. According to CNBC, as many as 99 out of every 100 applications weren't able to be processed. One healthcare.gov user was asked politely to wait 40 times. In a recent piece in Bloomberg Businessweek, writer and programmer Paul Ford laid out the root and the nature of healthcare.gov's bungled launch.
It's a little bit like a restaurant where you go into the dining room and you place your order. I want to get some healthcare. I want you to show me a web page. Give me a picture. And a waiter runs back to the kitchen and says, hey, this is what I want. Except the kitchen caught fire. The waiters had no idea what was going on. Everybody was running around screaming. And the people were out there in the dining room waiting for their healthcare to show up. And nothing happened. And so you just keep multiplying that by hundreds of thousands of people and you have a real debacle.
That is a splendid metaphor, and I give you my word of honor, I will not attempt to flog it any further. I do want to ask you, though, the same question some congressional Republicans asked Kathleen Sebelius, the Secretary of Health and Human Services. What exactly are the design and software problems?
Pieces weren't talking to other pieces. What we're looking at is a process that was closed off involving a lot of contractors under a lot of political pressure and had to move relatively quickly. And clearly, they were not able to understand or simulate the situations that launching, that actually reaching real people who wanted real healthcare, would entail.
And you think the solution would have been to be far more transparent with open source software. Are you pretty certain that had the government been more transparent in the development of healthcare.gov, in the writing of the code, that it would have avoided the problems that cropped up on October 1st?
The short answer is yes. When you went to the first version of healthcare.gov in June, that actually was open source code. That was available for anyone to download, and it was created by a company called Development Seed. They used a ton of other software that was already open source. They saved an enormous amount of time and money by using that first and just taking what was available. And then when it was all done, they put it online. Very, very strangely, and without any clear explanation, the code has been pulled off of the internet.
Well, it's probably secreted somewhere in Area 51. Now, Paul, the reason we're having this conversation is we saw your post on Bloomberg Business Week. When I read the piece, I'm like, yeah, yeah, open source, right. And then, Paul, I read the comments thread.
Sure.
And saw a number of objections to your thesis, such as, this is not just a website, it is a full-blown platform that is dealing with all sorts of government databases, that there are all sorts of government regulations and laws about data, many hinging on privacy, and that generally the open source approach was simply unavailable to Kathleen Sebelius to build this enormous system.
It works for the Department of Defense. They've come out in favor of using open source in some of their projects and have been very, very clear. If you take away open source, we will have a less secure Department of Defense. And, you know, the second issue, it doesn't feel that if everyone can look at code, it could be secure. It feels like, oh, wow, some hacker's going to figure out what's going on. But it doesn't actually work that way, which goes back to the Department of Defense being okay with open source code. It's vulnerable in the same way that any code is vulnerable. Nothing's ever perfect, but lots of eyes on it can really make things better.
We're speaking on Thursday, 17 days into the life of healthcare.gov as a federal insurance exchange. Things beginning to go a little more smoothly?
You know, the reports are that 70% of the bugs have been solved or something along those lines. I'm assuming that when the president really wants you to fix a website, it gets fixed. They're going to get a good website out the door that actually works because it really looks bad if they didn't. But we won't know what went wrong. If the process had been different, we'd have more insight.
Paul, I have one final thought. In sharing it, I have to actually break a previous vow. There's this saying, if people knew what went on in the kitchen, they wouldn't eat in the restaurant.
It's sort of like these modern restaurants where you get to watch the chefs at work. Or maybe it's like Benihana. The thing about open source is that you can walk back into the kitchen, and at some level, you're not just seeing what's going on. You also can put on the chef's hat and start cooking if you want. You can take that code and make it your own and start to improve it. I really do want to know what's going on in the kitchen. And I think that at some level, America deserves to know how our computer software is being prepared.
Dude, I think you may have coined a new term. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
Benihana care. Paul, thank you. That's the greatest response I've had in 13 years of doing this show.
That's why I'm here.
Paul Ford writes about technology for Bloomberg Business Week.
This week, Glenn Greenwald, best known as the reporter through which we learned of massive NSA domestic spying by way of Edward Snowden's leaks, announced that he was leaving the Guardian newspaper for what he called, quote, a once-in-a-career dream journalistic opportunity. It's a brand new venture funded by eBay founder Pierre Omidyar. Omidyar had already launched an investigative news outlet covering civic affairs in Hawaii called Honolulu Civil Beat. But with this new as yet unnamed outlet, he's putting $250 million of his own money behind Greenwald, his reporting partner in the Snowden story, filmmaker Laura Poitras, and Jeremy Scahill, late of The Nation. Jay Rosen, New York University journalism professor and founder of the Press Think blog, says Omidyar told him that he wants to build a new kind of news organization.
He wants first of all, to find more people like Glenn Greenwald who are independent journalists who have subject matter expertise. That's very important to him, as well as their own voice, as well as an online following. And then provide them with a platform and tools and support. He also believes that you need to bring the work of such journalists to a broader audience than their niches might allow them on their own.
You also described that he would try to strike the proper midpoint between voicey blogging and traditional journalism, in which the best of both are combined. Sometimes these things can completely work together, but sometimes they seem to be at odds.
The thing that Amidyar mentioned to me three or four times in our discussion was the importance of having strong editors so that you get the discipline of traditional journalism and the voice of blogging.
One of the reasons why I'm fascinated by this is because it harkens back to a time when some of the greatest journalism in American history was being produced around 1900, the days of the Muckrakers.
Yep, Lincoln Steffens, yeah.
Collier's Magazine, Munsey's, McClure's.
Right.
That had particular points of view.
That's right.
But the reporting was extremely highly regarded and very influential.
If you go back to The Shame of the Cities, Lincoln Steffens' book about municipal corruption, one of the things he says by way of introduction is, my purpose here wasn't just to lay out the facts. I wanted to destroy the facts. Meaning he wanted to end municipal corruption. That kind of reporting gave birth to what we think of as investigative reporting today.
The moment when these magazines arose was precisely the time when there were two extremes of journalism. There was the rise of, quote, objectivity, incarnated in the New York Times under Adolph Ox, although it wasn't always reflected in the Times' pages. And then you had the yellow journalists that exaggerated facts and didn't really care that much about credibility. And much of the public at that time didn't either. I wonder whether or not we have the same public with the same appetites, and within that public, there is an audience that is hungry for something like McClure's or Collier's.
There is an opportunity for a form of journalism which obeys the highest standards of verification and at the same time maximizes personal voice by trying to combine those two things in a technologically advanced way, you might get to a kind of news organization that we haven't seen before.
Ryan Tate wrote in Wired that it's hard not to feel optimistic when a billionaire says he wants to plow hundreds of millions of dollars into supporting independent journalists. But these tech billionaires have tried this before. Salon has losses of over $116 million. Slate cost Microsoft $20 million before it was sold to the Post Company. You survey this landscape. In your view, is he trying something that hasn't been tried before?
I think he has some things in mind that he hasn't revealed yet. Because when I asked him questions like that, I could tell that he was kind of drawing a curtain around certain things that he doesn't want to reveal yet. I think it's very significant that Omidyar is undertaking this project after his experience with Civil Beat in Honolulu. Because he started out with certain ideas about that project and then had to modify them through the experience of learning how hard it is to produce a news site that can sustain itself. Civil Beat now, with its alliance with Huffington Post Hawaii, is in a very different place than it was when it started. If he was the sort of billionaire who started out with a sort of a naive idea about remaking the online journalism landscape and was quick to realize that it's just a money pit, that would have already happened. And here he is, after this experience, doing this site, which was supposed to be civic engagement in serious public policy matters in Hawaii, not only willing to do it again, but to pour more into it. on an even bigger scale.
Jay, thank you very much.
You are so welcome.
Jay Rosen is a journalism professor at NYU. He blogs at presslink.org.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. I don't know much about my history before my grandparents arrived here from Europe, but I carry some of that history in my genes. History that goes way back to when Homo sapiens mixed with the Neanderthals. If you send $99 and some saliva to a DNA analysis and data bank like 23andMe, they'll send you your genetic history, even information about unknown third cousins in, say, Iowa or Ireland. And they'll also send you a set of probabilities of your odds of developing certain diseases, of being sensitive to certain medications, of sneezing in sunlight, and so on. They'll also keep and continue to crunch your genetic data. I decided to send saliva to 23andMe, and so did OTM producer PJ Vogt. When we got the test kits, we went into the studio to talk about it. You'll also hear senior producer Katya Rogers and former OTM producer Jamie York. Okay, so let's tear them open.
All right.
PJ.
Yeah.
Why do you want to do this?
Well, it's basically just for very small and petty reasons, and I feel like maybe I'm uncorking something that I haven't thought hard enough about. You know that I drink a lot of Diet Coke every day?
Oh, yeah.
And I read this thing where Peter Orszag, who used to be Obama's budget guy, he also does, and he took this test and found out that he has this is really medical looking. He has a genetic thing that lets him metabolize caffeine faster. So this thing that he's doing actually makes sense because of his chemistry or whatever. The other thing is I'm in a fight with my mom about a food allergy that she believes that I have that I don't believe that I have. And it would be nice to have proof.
So that's why you wanted to do this?
That's what got me started on it.
For me, it's pretty different.
What's yours?
Well, initially, I just wanted to know how much Neanderthal DNA I had. But I also think that I'll find all sorts of information useful. I mean, the big difference, well, there are lots of differences between us, PJ, but one of them is 30 years. And for you, the likelihood of, say, developing Alzheimer's is more academic than I think it is for me.
Does that make you kind of not want to do it, though? I mean, if you can't do anything to prevent these things, then...
If you're on the alert for it, then you don't have to go through the agonizing process of dragging everyone else through it for a prolonged period of time when you don't actually have any real quality of life.
But you do have to go through the agony of, like, I don't know, knowing that...
You know, I started wearing black on my 13th birthday, PJ. In fact, it will, I hope, give me a greater appreciation for the good health that I currently have.
Okay, so you guys are sitting there talking about what you want from the test. What about your families? Don't they have any say in it?
No.
Nothing.
I mean, the information is for me. I don't have to share any of this with anybody if I don't want to.
I wouldn't do it.
Why not?
Because if I did it and I found out something that was going to be coming down the line at me, like Parkinson's or something, when would I tell my kids? Or my partner? That's going to be his life too.
I have to say, I don't get it. I always want to know.
One of my friends that I grew up with had cystic fibrosis, so knew that there was a clock ticking, and it was really defining. Like, it was the thing, you know, the first thing you'd say about a person would be that. Like, knowing probably how you're going to die and when you're going to die, I don't think it does make you live more or appreciate things more. I think I have this fantasy that I would find out that I knew how much time I had, and in doing that, I would spend it better than knowing abstractly that I'm going to die. And I don't think that's true. I think death kind of crowds everything else out.
Sitting next to you right now is Jamie York. I'm just wondering, your father was adopted, right?
My father was adopted twice. My mother's father was adopted.
So that leaves you with no knowledge of like 3/4 of your genetic code, would you be interested in doing something like this?
No, I find the prospect of it absolutely terrifying.
Why?
I don't want to know what's coming. I can rationally understand the argument. I don't have the psychological fortitude to compartmentalize that information. You know, my mom died when she was 56. So by your argument, if I had known that she had a high propensity for something that might kill her when she was young, then in theory, I could have made use of that information.
More to the point, she could have.
She could have. But I don't think she could have lived her life differently. And I don't think I could have sort of managed that information. I think it would haunt me.
Mm-hmm.
My probably greatest fear is something like Huntington's that comes on in your late 40s and is irreversible and untreatable. I don't want any part of that.
I think that fundamentally what motivates me more than anything is curiosity.
You've got such a firm foundation of existential dread that there's nothing that could really disrupt it. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. It's kind of a cliche, but I think it probably just heightens our kind of emotional predispositions anyway.
Like anything else.
Yeah.
Yeah. Once you know you can find out, you have to find out.
Should we spit?
Okay. I'm doing it now. This is radio gold. People are really going to like the sound of us spitting into plastic tubes. Is yours turning red?
Mm-mm.
Huh. Probably doesn't mean anything. Am I bleeding?
That's taken forever.
Yeah, it says nothing about red.
It's probably blood. You'll probably be fine.
It's probably blood. You'll probably be fine.
Okay.
All right. I keep my sample. You keep your sample. Oh, so Brooke, we're not... Mm-hmm. First of all, we didn't do this in the state of New York because we're not legally allowed to.
Why not?
Because New York has strict regulations about who's allowed to test and collect DNA. So we did this in another state where that's legal. And then we're going to find out our futures.
We won't. We'll just find out a set of probabilities.
I want to know exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah, that's not going to happen. The fact is, your spit is more important to 23andMe than your $99. Patrick Chung, a 23andMe board member, told Fast Company that, quote, once you have the data, the company does actually become the Google of personalized healthcare. Genetic data on a massive scale sold to drug companies, hospitals, and even governments is where the real growth potential is. So inevitably, the issue of privacy rears its head. While PJ and I wait for our results to come in, WNYC reporter Mary Harris brings us a cautionary tale about a family of sorts reunited by a gene data bank. In this case, not 23andMe.
Lance was 38, single, living the life of a typical tech worker in California. Long days in Silicon Valley, ultimate frisbee and Bud Light on the weekends. And then he got this email.
Yeah, I mean, even remembering it now, my heart starts to pound a little bit.
The subject line, interesting information.
The email reads, Lance, where to begin? My name is Ryan Kramer. I'm 15 years old, and I live in Nederland, Colorado. 15 years ago, my mother was impregnated with a sperm donation from California Cryobank donor 1058. You may want to sit down for this next part. It's like a science fiction movie. Nobody emails you out of the blue to tell you you're their father.
He'd been an anonymous sperm donor. Lance's son, Ryan, and Ryan's mom, Wendy, had found a way to track him down by using Ryan's DNA and the DNA in public databases. Ryan did it to answer a long, unanswered question.
I feel like my curiosity came in waves throughout my upbringing. There was always like this real desire to see a picture or to meet this person.
For Ryan's mother, Wendy, it was more than that.
I felt like I owed it to him. I
brought him into the world with that particular set of circumstances, and I felt like it was my responsibility then to help him find the answers he was looking for.
Wendy spent nearly a decade helping Ryan dig up clues.
So I would call the sperm bank like every year, every couple of years, just to see anything new.
She had some basics. The cryobank identified Ryan's father as donor 1058.
Somebody there inadvertently told me that there were at least, I think at that point, either 3 or 9 half-brothers and sisters out there. And I thought, oh God, you know, as soon as I tell Ryan, of course he's going to say, okay, when can I meet them?
Knowing that there were half-siblings out there sparked an idea for Wendy and Ryan way back in 2000. What if they could connect with these genetic brothers and sisters, track down different branches of their donor's family tree? So Wendy started a Yahoo group. She called it the Donor Sibling Registry. It was a place where kids like Ryan could share information about themselves and their donor fathers.
So basically, we created a place where you could be found if people were looking for you. If there are donors who want to know any of the children they've helped to create, why shouldn't they have a way to make mutual consent contact?
For a month or two, Wendy and Ryan were the only people logged in. But then a story in the local news led to calls from Good Morning America, Oprah, 60 Minutes.
Ryan set off on a mission to find his donor dad.
Ryan Kramer stepped out of the shadows seeking answers.
You said that there were traits that obviously didn't come from you.
With the help of fellow donor kids, Ryan's file folder on 1058 grew fatter.
Anywhere that we could possibly gather any sort of additional information that could eventually help us figure out who he was, it's sort of something we did.
They even did a public record search for all the men born on their donor's birthday in their donor's birth city.
And we got back this list of, it was probably about 350 people. And we thought, you know, there's a pretty good chance that one of these guys is my donor.
And this is where DNA made all the difference. The TV appearances, the internet activism, even the record searches would have been useless if Ryan hadn't found his way to an online DNA database. Ryan sent a sample of his saliva to a website that promises to uncover your ancestry. For $99, they'll tell you if you're Native American. Make it $169, they'll check to see if you're a distant relative of Thomas Jefferson. He didn't expect much.
One of the other features that this website had was this sort of relative finder type of feature where it would notify you if anybody else was related to you.
Sure enough, he began to connect with distant family, and the two men who were Ryan's closest genetic relatives had something else in common, a last name. Remember, Wendy and Ryan had done that public record search, and because last names are passed from father to son, father to son.
One of us had a thought, I wonder on that list of all the males born on that day in that county that your donor's name is on, I wonder if there's anyone on that list with that last name.
Lance was the only match.
At that point, we're sort of dumbfounded, like, oh my God.
Neither Lance nor his close relatives had ever put their own DNA online, but just a snippet of shared genetic code from distant cousins with a common last name was enough to reveal his identity. Ryan says their research proves that at least for sperm donors, the notion of privacy may be obsolete.
Because there's always the possibility that at some point somebody's going to come knocking and, you know, sort of like I did, want some answers.
My favorite one is number 5 here with a 15-year-old kid.
George Church is a geneticist at Harvard. Here he is at a conference on innovation in 2010.
Found his surname, found his father on the first shot.
He says the implications go far beyond sperm donors, because the rapid growth of DNA testing may make privacy more elusive for all of us.
If a 15-year-old boy can do it, then anybody can do it. Now, this kid had an unfair advantage in that he knew himself. He could analyze his own DNA. But I think increasingly that's going to be possible to figure that out for people, even people that you don't know.
But Church thinks losing a little privacy might make all of us a lot healthier.
Privacy is kind of a new invention. It's not something that's been with us forever. You know, if you go to tribes even today or even small towns today, pretty much everybody knows everything, right? You don't want your privacy to be held against you. If no one knows that you've got something unusual going on, then you're not going to be helped. So if there are lots of computers crawling around looking at your data, then there's a chance they'll catch something that you didn't catch.
Back in California, Ryan's father, Lance, is still trying to make up his mind about the benefits and risks of being genetically outed.
It is very difficult to imagine that anyone will be able to keep their DNA lineage anonymous. It's something we're going to live with in the future. We're living with today, apparently. He's my donor offspring, and he's a great kid. He's my younger half-clone.
But even though he's already been identified, he asked us not to use his last name because he knows he has other children out there, and he's not sure how many more he wants tracking him down. For On the Media, I'm Mary Harris.
So after a month or so, PJ and I get our results, which we send to a geneticist for more analysis and context through a company called Promethease. We'll bring him in later. So we've got it. Well, go ahead and open your Coke.
Well,
speaking of which, did you find out whether or not you're a fast caffeine metabolizer?
That was maybe the only good piece of news in my entire report, is that I am a fast caffeine metabolizer, and it actually is better for my heart instead of worse for my heart.
Huh.
Yeah.
Excellent. So what was the bad news?
Just everything else.
Really?
I have a high risk of gout. Gout wasn't in my original report, but I got an email a week after I got my results being like, hey, you've got an update. And I clicked through and it was like, 35% chance that you'll develop gout when you get older.
Now that's a fantastic finding because you can moderate your diet. You can respond to that.
But I don't want any, like, I thought either it would say that I was really healthy or it would say, I think maybe young people have a tendency to imagine dying very dramatically. So I thought it was going to be like, you've got PJ Vogt disease and you've got 6 months to live. I didn't think it was going to say, you need to take care of yourself. Otherwise, as you get older, you are likely to get the diseases that all people get as they age.
Bummer, man. It just reminds you of your mortality. When you saw that your results came in, were you scared?
I was immensely scared. I mean, it gave me 20 things to Google that I'd never heard of that all sounded ominous. I mean, I didn't know what a venous thromboembolism was.
That's the thing that I have.
Me too.
Increase of. Oh, hey, I bet you it's an Ashkenazi thing.
Yeah, I found out I'm 30% Ashkenazi, which I didn't
know.
Oh,
you're only 37%? I am 97% Ashkenazi. When it looks for your history across the globe, it seemed like I spontaneously sprang up in the middle of the Ukraine somewhere. It's a little disappointing. Even more disappointing was being only 2.7%. Neanderthal.
I'm sorry about that. I know that was important to you.
What were you?
I think I was a little bit more.
You're not worthy.
I was like 3.5%, I think.
See, you got a little above average. You know, your man crush, James Fallows, is 5%.
Seriously?
And that is way above average.
He's 5% Neanderthal and he can fly a plane. That's crazy.
So the things that I kind of expected, like tendency to obesity, diabetes 2, this venous thromboembolism thing was kind of a new idea.
One of the main reasons I initially wanted to do this was that I've been in a prolonged fight with my family. They all have gluten allergies, and they think that I do and that I'm in denial. And so I wanted conclusive proof that I don't. And my test said that I do.
Ultimately, were you glad you did this?
Oh, God, yeah. For me, it was really interesting to see where I'm from. My family has a bit of a weird genealogy, and we're pretty far flung, and there's been a lot of conjecture about it. They give you a map, and they say not only you had family in Spain, and you had family that were Jewish, and you had family in Germany, but also they say, like, there's a person in Iowa who is 5% related to you. And I brought up a person who the social networking component said was my relative, and my mom said, oh, yeah, it was her mother's estranged sister. So it was a branch of my mom's family that she'd completely lost touch with but heard about. So she's now doing the test and she wants to message this woman.
Wow. I found a lot of people who were second to third cousins.
You found a lot of them?
Yeah.
A lot of people actually asked me to share my genetic information with them. And it's one of the first times where I've actually felt uncomfortable about oversharing on a social network.
Mm-hmm.
That felt like a silly thing
to do.
Yeah,
that is unusual for you.
Yeah.
So we're going to bring in now Greg Lennon, who is a geneticist who has looked at our material through the Promethease site. Greg, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brooke.
What do you think were the most unusual findings for PJ and for me?
Well, why don't you tell me first what you noticed?
Well, I noticed an increased risk for breast cancer, personally. It seems that the average risk is 13.5, but my risk is 18.3%, and I don't know what I should do with that information. Can you explain to me how they came to that?
sure in the population, which in this case probably means mostly Caucasian females, your risk is estimated to be that number. Now, the real question, though, is that important? And is it something you would either worry about or discuss with your physician? And the answer in that case is probably, well, there's no harm in discussing it with your physician.
I knew you were going to say that.
Right?
You took this test yourself. You said if you were going to be making sausage, you want to know what it tastes like. You know, was there a finding that you went, holy cow, or did you say, this is interesting, perhaps I should consult my physician about some moderate changes in lifestyle?
Yeah, we did do this first years ago. And when I first took part of my report to my doctor, they have absolutely no idea what I was talking about. This is all too new for them. Now, it's getting better. And in areas like breast cancer, it actually is better. In my case, breast cancer actually was something of very personal importance, not to me, but to someone who was very close to me, and was brought up with the physician and did change the course of therapy.
Did she have the BRCA markers?
No. The truth is, most women with breast cancer do not have BRCA1 markers, and certainly not the common ones.
I feel like I've been given a lot of information and I'm not sure how to responsibly use it. I don't know what level of attention to pay now when I read an article that says scientists may have found a DNA marker for whatever, if I should immediately rush back, try to see if I've got it, or if I should hold off because it's just going to scare and confuse me and I'm basically going to misunderstand what I've been given.
Okay, that's a really easy one to answer.
Okay.
You hear something in the news, totally ignore it.
That was my policy already. That's great.
According to the 23andMe results, I have a slightly lower risk for Alzheimer's, but a higher risk for other cognitive issues?
In general, anytime DNA speaks about cognitive issues and things having to do with the brain, you've really got to realize we're really in early days.
Mm-hmm.
There are many, many, many factors that are playing a role, not only just in your DNA, but in your environment, in your education, and for all we know, what you had for breakfast. Small, slight risks are really nothing that you can act on.
According to my results, I have a slightly higher likelihood of having celiac disease, or at least a gluten allergy. It was a very slim probability, but then I got sort of a health report saying, this is something you should talk to a doctor about. Where should I pitch my level of anxiety?
You willing to hear a little bit of statistics?
Yes.
That DNA change that you have is one found in almost everybody with celiac disease, with gluten intolerance, serious gluten intolerance. On the other hand, it just happens that there are a whole lot of people wandering around who don't have any obvious sign of gluten intolerance who also carry that change. Basically, when you get told you have this marker, well, yeah, you do share it with the folks who have celiac disease, but in the absence of any other information, the odds are about 15 to 1 in favor of you not getting celiac disease.
Huh. So not on 23andMe, but in your results, it said that I had something called a warrior gene, and I was curious about that.
Well,
oh.
Doesn't mean you ought to join the special forces. It does mean that people with the warrior gene have a slightly higher statistical likelihood of, in stressful situations, fighting rather than fleeing, or as tested by the equivalent psychological test done on college students who need to make a little money in a lab after school sometime.
Wait, so how do they stress out the college kids?
You can't think of ways to stress out college kids.
Was there anything about either of our results that struck you as somewhat unusual?
Well, probably the most important thing that leapt out in your report was that using Plavix, one of the most commonly prescribed drugs right now to treat or prevent stroke and heart attacks, isn't going to do you much good. If you're ever there and your cardiologist or other physician is saying, hey, here's the drug for you, well, you could just say, it doesn't look like it. Why don't we try a different drug that's more likely to be effective? In PJ's report, he's predicted to be lactose intolerant. He may not have had the slightest idea that now or later in his life, that ice cream may just give him an upset stomach. Maybe he already knows it now.
It's funny, actually, I do know it because I'm terribly lactose intolerant. But for most of my childhood, I didn't know, and I got sick all the time. I mean, if this had been around, I could have spent a lot less time vomiting milk, which would have been great.
Yeah, and you know, of course, in this field, more and more people are moving towards, oh, hey, why don't we do these sort of analyses right at birth? A lot of this science will merge into your, hopefully, electronic medical record.
It also said I was more likely than most people to become addicted to heroin.
Yeah. Again, those are some of these reports that you may just want to not believe that the first or second time it's reported, but, you know, wait and let the studies build up.
The study that suggests that I'm higher than average in empathy or something, that's a bunch of hooey, right?
Yep.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
DNA is not destiny. You can have identical twins who, as far as we know, share almost totally identical DNA, and they can have different medical histories.
What about privacy issues? Any concern there?
Wouldn't say there are a lot of issues right now, honestly, in part because we just know so little. Now, maybe when we know a lot more, having your DNA out there in the world will be problematic. But the truth is, we won't be able to control that anyway. Your DNA is out there, whether it's on the surfaces of things you touch or elsewhere, and sooner or later, somebody could get access to it. Now, fortunately, we also have things like the so-called GINA, Genetic Non-Disclosure Act, that does protect us a bit legally, at least here in the U.S., from having DNA information used against you.
I just remembered there's one question I'm going to be really mad at myself if I don't ask. In the category of like things that are reliable versus things that are hooey, it said that I will not have male pattern baldness. Can you tell me that that's not hooey?
Not hooey.
Really?
You've got a really reduced risk of male pattern baldness.
Oh, that's great. That's
great. You can count on that one.
Okay, cool.
See, simple things make simple people happy. Bye, Greg.
Good talking to you, PJ and Brooke.
Oh, thank you.
Greg Lennon is a geneticist with Snipedia, which is kind of like Wikipedia for DNA information.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, and Laura Mayer. We had more help from Zach Spencer and Megan Tian. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Andrew Dunn and Justin Gerrish.
And funding for Mary's piece came from Susan and Peter Solomon. Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.